Welcome to another edition of Beethoven, Crisis and Creativity. And with us today, special guest, John Nakamatsu, great pianist. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Great to have you. And Ray Hatoda, music director of the Fresno Philharmonic.
Hello.
Great to have you here, Ray, as well. John Nakamatsu made his name in 1997 as a gold medalist at the 10th Van Cliburn International Piano Competition, and he's been performing and touring ever since then. He's performed both with the Fresno Philharmonic and many times on the Philip Lenz International Keyboard Concert Series, and we're thankful to both Fresno Philharmonic and the Keyboard Concert Series for their collaboration in this special series. Talking about Beethoven, music of his times, and social issues of his times, and how he responded to them, and how that relates to our times, and why do we care about Beethoven, what makes Beethoven relevant. And we're going to be talking about three pieces today, in particular, Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata, the Piano Sonata, Opus 53, the Eroica Symphony, and the little bit on the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto with John Nakamatsu, performed with Fresno Philharmonic in 2018. Ray, go ahead and kick things off. How did you and John first meet?
Well, John and I first met when we performed together with the Fresno Philharmonic, and John came and played Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1, and that was, like you said, in 2018. And was wonderful was that we got a chance to do some forehand duets together too that weekend. Remember, John?
I do remember. Yeah, that was fun. That was really great.
Yeah, the Petite Suite by Debussy.
That's right. We were rehearsing backstage in the wings. I remember that.
Yes. And what an honor it was for me to play side by side with you.
Not at all.
And just that small piece. But we just really, I think we collaborated so well together. And I know the audiences in Fresno really adore you and your playing and your artistry. And we just love having you in Fresno. So it was such an opportunity for you to make your debut with us.
That's right. That was, you know, I grew up, 3 hours from Fresno in San Jose. And that was the first time I'd played with the orchestra. And it was so exciting. And it was, you know, so great because my parents came, my wife was there, we had family, friends in the audience. So it was just a very exciting time. And, you know, of course, I've been to the city many times to play on the university series, of course, the Philip Lorenz. And that's always an incredible experience. I just find the audience is so piano friendly. And it's really, it's a great thing because, you know, there aren't that many series dedicated specifically to keyboard only left in this country. I mean, after things started changing, you know, when I started performing, I was primarily doing recitals and now I'm primarily doing concertos. So I think that's the nature of the profession in this modern time. And of course, now I'm doing nothing, but that's a whole different story. But
so we want to talk about Beethoven. Specifically, we want to aim towards this heroic period of Beethoven. We're talking from 1803 to 1812. It's considered the middle period. And this middle period of Beethoven is all about his pushing forward his ability and his creativity any way he could. And with the restraints that he had, with the illnesses that he was facing, with the political upheaval that he was facing. So we're going to really hone in on two specific works during this time. In 1804, he wrote both of these works, the Waldstein's Piano Sonata, Opus 53, and the Eroica Symphony, Opus 55. I want to quickly just give everyone a scenario of what Beethoven was feeling during this time. And we had just talked last week about the Heiligenstadt Testament, this testament that he wrote about his suffering, about his coming to terms with his illnesses, specifically his onset deafness that was really hindering him from, you know, being a full 360 musician. I mean, can you imagine not being able to hear and be this incredible composer? So it was during this time of despair and really a lot of isolation. And again, we're all feeling so isolated as musicians during this time. And I think that he, during this heroic period, he wrote, "I was yet obliged in life to isolate myself and to pass my existence in solitude. But to my art, I owe the fact that I did not end my life with suicide." But he pushed forward. And again, as artists, we need to persevere. And these two compositions that we're going to talk about really, really speak to that. And it was like Beethoven was doing this great rallying cry, a heroic act in itself. So I want to ask John specifically about the Waldstein Sonata. Have you played it before?
Yes.
How many times?
quite a lot. You know, it was one of my favorite pieces in my youth. You know, of course, it's like every piano student, you know, you start discovering the Beethoven sonatas, and then that's one of them that, of course, pops out. And it also is, you know, one of the sonatas that immediately present itself as a roadblock because it's so difficult. And even just technically to negotiate all of the demands of what he wrote. And so, you know, it was a challenge then and it's still a challenge now. And but that is to say, it is such incredible, revolutionary, innovative, inspiring music that no matter what period of life I think you attempted, it speaks to us as humans just making our way toward the future.
Yes, and you spoke about how difficult it was. Exactly. So this is one of the first sonatas that Beethoven really expands this notion of virtuosity. Prior to that, it was really about form and about being contained in this classical sonata form. But now he's really expanding on this virtuosity. And what I find so amazing about Beethoven's music is that so much of it is this rhythmic element that drives the music. Sometimes we don't really hear the melody. And when we think of the opening of the Waldstein Sonata, what do we hear? We hear driving eighth notes. That's all in C major.
I think it's so exciting.
It's so exciting. And you don't hear anything. You just hear these thirds and these fifths in mm-hmm. in the both hands and just driving eighth notes rhythm. And you're like, that's the Waldstein Sonata. Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that's it's an incredible opening, but it's also incredible because what we forget with our modern sensibilities is that this was probably in itself a shocking thing to hear in a sonata right off the bat, just to hear rhythm and to hear harmony and to hear nothing else. There's no melody there. I mean, you can argue that there is some kind of melodic element in rhythm, but you know, to somebody who's used to immediately getting the presentation of the first theme, or at least an introduction, and then the theme very quickly, as was the tradition, is going to be very taken aback, at least at first. You know, within all of this new innovation and this new type of writing and this expressivity that before that period was really quite, quite different, there's still an incredible use of form, and that it's an expansion in the most ingenious way on a given form, which was sonata, you know, first movement sonata form. He does the same things that he's always done. Continuing what Haydn and Mozart was doing too, just in a completely new and innovative way. It's still shocking a little bit to us as modern listeners. Imagine if you're hearing it for the first time and, you know, we're only used to hearing things Mozart and before, you know, so we forget that aspect of his creativity. I
think. Right. And not only that it's this rhythmic drive, but that rhythmic drive provides this underlying tension. And this is the moment that we really hear for the first time this expression of music that's beyond technicalities. It's free form, but I think it was this expanded form of, you know, pushing the envelope, pushing Beethoven being revolutionary with just almost the simplest aspect mm-hmm. of rhythm. And then we think of, you know, if after Beethoven, after all the late piano sonatas, all the experimentation that he did with all of his music, going beyond Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and the Ninth Symphony, and then really pushing us into the Romantic era. And so the most virtuosic piece I can think of, John, you know, top of my mind is like Liszt Dante Sonata.
Sure, which is
expansive use of a sonata form. I don't think so. It's really, and in the title, it is this quasi fantasia. You know, it's like fantasy sonata. And Beethoven also used that in his Opus 27 sonatas earlier on. You know, he's really pushing us forward into this new world, this new idealism of music and pushing out the classical and into the romantic. But let's go back to the first movement of the Waldstein Sonata. You were saying about the form being expanded, and this first movement has so much material in it. Like I said, it opens up with eighth notes and then it goes into 16th notes, you know, so it's like motion and then faster motion. But then the second theme comes in and it's a totally different feeling. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the second theme in the first movement is more like just suddenly a choir appears. And then, you know, we're having this this very peaceful moment. But you know what? What's interesting is that even behind this and behind this ethereal aspect of it, you still feel the effect of what you heard before, meaning the rhythmic drive, as you're saying. And this rhythmic drive, you know, it has the effect of carrying through the entire piece. I mean, this the other interesting thing about the sonata is there's this giant arc that starts right at that first measure, but that goes not only just through the first movement, but through the entire piece. And so that you feel that there's this oneness of a complete work. And that even is, I wouldn't say new, but a relatively unique idea in that even in Beethoven's time, it was not uncommon for him to just premiere or play, you know, movements separately in performance, or you'd have a movement of this, and then you go to something else, and then you hear the second movement later, and then you, well, in this piece, the way it's played, you'd almost not want to do that because you feel that there's no stop and there's no just kind of disconnect between the movements, that they were put together for a very specific reason, and that is a compositional unity. And that motivic idea, that, you know, the idea that melody is not the driving force, but, you know, a theme is not the driving force, but actually ideas, motives, things that are rhythmic and will repeat themselves and basically evolve into other things. That's a huge can of worms. And it only grew and grew and grew well into the 20th century, where you have the second Viennese school and people were writing music only based on motivic ideas, and that everything stemmed from one pattern or one type of statement. So it's revolutionized music in ways that I think are still, it's still going to go somewhere. So it's really incredible. I mean, he changed the course of music and the way people think.
Absolutely. So going back to the first movement of the
sonata. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay.
There's so much to talk about. And, you know,
can you tell us a little bit about the virtuosity of the in the development, where we have the right hand playing the melody in different tessituras? So it's like the right hand is having a conversation with itself. You know, you go from the very top register to the low middle register top, and it's jumping back and forth. Can you talk a little bit about how the movement is developed?
You touch on a really important theme, and this is kind of virtuosity. And, you know, this was still a force behind Beethoven's creation at this time. You know, you look at the Appassionata Sonata, obviously it is to show off Beethoven as much as a composer, as a pianist, because, you know, when these works were to show off your skill on the instrument. And this writing was almost, in some ways, you know, like, you know, nobody can play this. No one can do this. If you can play this, you know, you must come from somewhere else. And so there's that aspect of it, which also then continued through Liszt and Chopin and Rachmaninoff and, you know, these composers who wrote, well, you know, I'm going to write the hardest piece.
And Scriabin. I love Scriabin.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah. There's that. Then there's also, as you're talking about different registers and showing the capability of writing for an instrument that is really undergoing significant changes at this time. And so that's yet another layer that's just so fascinating about this period, because we don't really understand, even in our creative world today, how fast instruments were changing, namely the piano especially, because not only did it suddenly shift from plucking strings to hitting strings in just, you know, 100 years before or less, suddenly the pianos were getting bigger and louder. The shapes were changing. The way you'd position it in a hall was changing. By the early 1800s, like the 1820s, the mid-1820s, you had the steel frame put into the piano so you could stretch and hold these metal strings with incredible tension. And that gave harmonics a new life. It gave just volume and what you can do. The actions were becoming faster and more responsive. So you notice the writing just a few opuses before is so drastically different than now. He's asking you to do these trills and these other kinds of things that, you know, you couldn't do just years before. So you got to just wonder, is it it's a chicken or the egg. Is it the instrument driving the creativity, or is it actually these composers pushing for these new instruments to have it? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I think it's a little bit of both. But
and what an exciting time. Yeah, what an exciting time for Beethoven to be writing and experimenting. So not only was he doing that inside of himself and pushing himself further and further as an artist, but around him, the instruments, the stage that he was, you know, living in, right. The moment that he was living in had so much upheaval and change. And as we go through so many of this pandemic and so many changes, every week there's like news, big news, and that right. changes our lives, you know. I get this moment of fear, you know, because I don't want change. I don't know what that's like. And maybe we should embrace it like Beethoven did and just say, let's just do it. Let's just go forward and push as far as we can. And what does that look like?
I think also, you know, we look back at the period with obviously our own reflections in some ways. You know, you always look at history from our lives and our standpoint. You know, we often forget that, you know, Beethoven didn't write just for the sake of doing something new. I mean, that was a byproduct of what he did. And obviously he was interested in innovation, but you know, you are a product of your time as well. And in that way, he wasn't working in Vienna in a vacuum. You know, Vienna was this kind of hotbed of musical activity at the beginning of the 1800s. And every composer and every pianist and every person who was anybody was writing in Vienna. And if you wanted the commissions, you needed to do something a little different. And if you wanted the attention of this person or that person, you have to write in a certain way. And so, you know, there were all kinds of influences, and some were actually at the level of being rivals to Beethoven. And I think there's a school of thought that says that these people, these pianists, these composers, who are completely forgotten today, in some ways made Beethoven what he is, because he needed to excel. He needed to distinguish himself. And so he was constantly thinking of what could he do better, and how is he going to exist in amidst all this competition. And there were even, you know, because of his personality, he was not the easiest person to get along with. There were other people who would probably politically get things that he didn't get. And he felt that he needed to always remember that, you know. So there's just so much going on and so many factors that made Beethoven the Beethoven for us. What he actually thought about what was, you know, his creative goals, you know, I think that's a whole different story too.
Let's talk about Beethoven as a pianist. And there are stories about Beethoven wrecking pianos by banging them so hard, trying to get every single note out. And there was these apocryphal stories about the poor deaf man pounding on the keys and the poor piano in shreds after the aftermath of his playing on these instruments. And you were mentioning about the pianos having this massive transformation during this about 70 years, less than 100 years during Beethoven's time. So can we talk about where the piano was before 1800? And then as he was writing the Waldstein Sonata, and the Broadwood pianos that came after, maybe about 10 years later.
The pianoforte really started off as a completely wooden framed and supported instrument. So there was no metal in these, you know, all the nails and everything was done with wood. And then the only thing that might not have been wood, of course, was the keyboard, the ivory, or whatever you put onto the keytops, if you put ivory.
What are on the keytops now?
Plastic.
Plastic. Yes.
Actually, good quality plastic. I sometimes prefer the plastic to the ivory, but
okay.
but yeah, no ivory. You can't do that anymore. But and then also there was leather that used to be on the dampers and the hammers. You know, so those kinds of things would hit, and then that was gradually replaced by other materials, and then felt, which in the modern era is more controllable. So prior to, you know, this period, the piano was, I wouldn't say a fragile instrument, but it didn't have the strength that the modern pianos have. One of the interesting things that some of those older pianos had were more pedals or less pedals. And so you never really knew what you were going to get, you know. And I've seen these pianos with 7 pedals, you know, and they do all kinds of things. And the funny thing is that in some ways, Beethoven just understood that he wasn't going to write notations for 7 different pedals. He would maybe notate soft pedal and sustain it.
Right. But, and so right now in our modern piano, we have 3 pedals.
Generally, right? 3. Yes. Yeah. a soft pedal, a sustaining pedal, and a pedal that holds individual notes if you want it to. So it's the least used of all of them. So it's really the two, the soft and the sustained, that Beethoven and that all composers really write for. And I think he would have just assumed that by putting an indication that you would figure out the effect that he wanted. Because there were certain things about notating in the score that are common and that we all learn, but that had different meaning because of his instrument. There are these long passages of pedals, even in the Waldstein Sonata, where you just, if you played it that way on the monitors, like put the pedal down and played, it would sound like a mess. It would just sound like soup. So you have to figure out how you negotiate that. But, you know, maybe what he wanted was the pedal point, the root of the harmony, but not much else. You know, and maybe what he wanted was the harmonic kind of sounds coming from the rest of the instrument, the dissonances, but in a very background kind of way. And I think you hear that even in the opening of the third movement, you know, where you just have these long C major chords, but you just are to hold the pedal down. And if you do it on the modern piano, suddenly the instrument starts to overwhelm itself, because too much sound is happening. And then, you know, the modern pianos, again, where it's everything from Beethoven's time on was about longer sustain, more sound, the ability to project into bigger spaces, bigger dynamic contrast. So, you know, with all of this sustained sound that we have, it sounds nothing like the transparency that Beethoven heard in his instrument. So for us playing this music, it's like we're playing a transcription. That this music wasn't really written for our instrument. But
also in the same vein, I remember learning this piano sonata as an undergrad. And I remember my piano teacher saying, flutter pedal, flutter pedal. And that's basically my right foot is like spastic.
That's right.
While I'm trying to play all those notes.
Absolutely.
At the same time.
Let's listen to the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 21 in C major, Opus 53, The Waldstein, performed here by Jonathan Biss, a frequent performer in the Philip Lorenz International Keyboard Concert Series. Thank you. That was the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 21 in C major, Opus 53, the Waldstein Sonata, performed by Jonathan Biss. This is Beethoven, Creativity and Crisis from Valley Public Radio. We continue our discussion of this sonata with Ray Hotoda, music director of the Fresno Philharmonic, and our special guest, pianist John Nakamatsu.
You mentioned the third movement. I'd love to talk about the rondo, the third movement, which I think is the polar opposite in sonority, in emotion, in just the output of sound than the first movement.
It is. And it's the ultimate contrast. And I think that's another reason why it is absolutely necessary to not separate these movements. And actually, before you get into the third movement, there's what he calls a second movement, I suppose, but it's really just an introduction into the third movement. It's not really a full-blown movement in itself. And, you know, he had used this form. There's another example of it in the A major cello sonata where that almost sounds more like it's going to be a movement because you have this beautiful E major theme and you think it's going to be developed, but somehow it just distills itself into a bridge to lead to the very exciting third movement. This is more or less what's happening here. It's a way to get out of that rhythmic drive of the first movement into something a lot more serene and just melodic. It is just so beautiful when it happens. It's like the sun kind of comes out of the clouds, you know. But it is so hard to control. And it is probably the part that terrifies most people.
Right. The first movement feels like, you know, you can get into it and it feels, you know, like, right. You can get your you know, hands dirty in it, you know, so to speak. And then you come to that third movement and all of a sudden your left hand is playing the melody.
Right.
Crossing over right. the right hand. Tell us a little bit about
not
that.
Not comfortable. Not good. That's not a good thing. And it, you know, clearly didn't make it for people with short arms. But you know, that's the other thing too, because again, the actions on his piano were vastly different than ours. Ours are much heavier. And you know, when you want the quickness of our instrument, I mean, our instruments are lightning fast compared to those instruments in some ways. We've always wanted more response time and greater power and that type of sonic precision. What had to happen was that things got heavier. And so on his piano, you could just, it almost like you put a feather on it and the keys can go down, you know? So you understand a lot of why these things were written and how they were supposed to be played. I think a lot of this type of the soft stuff, but also the very athletic stuff becomes much more difficult on our instruments because it's not really written for this action.
Let's talk about the prestissimo. Tell us a little bit about that section at the end of this third movement.
If you play it correctly, it is supposed to sound faster than the rest of the piece, but like, you know, so often it is just a little so crazy that, you know, sometimes pianists have already run out of gas before they've gotten to that moment, and it doesn't have the same effect. But I think, you know, if we don't think of it necessarily as a tempo indication, but just as the next level of reaching the kind of exciting, but it's still not in the same way the first movement is. You know, it's just a capstone of the material from that evolved from the third movement, but yet somehow reflects back to the opening, I think, you know, of that motivic idea, and you start hearing eighth notes again.
And I always think of this last movement, this prestissimo section. It's so triumphant, and there's mm-hmm. so much confidence in it. You know, it's like, yes, we're going to win. You know, we're gonna get there. But I remember this one darn glissando passage where you're having to play octaves in glissando in the right hand.
Yeah, again. Not for our instrument.
Right. So I remember my piano teacher saying, well, you can refinger it and play it with two hands.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me how you do it.
Usually two hands. I've also tried to just even play it with an octave really quickly because I cannot do an octave glissando. There's an octave glissando also in the first concerto, but almost nobody does that. And the glissando probably sounded different to Beethoven than it does to us. You know, we also have the hindsight of having the Liszt glissando, which, you know, then became maybe a little less deep, to put it mildly.
How do we do a Liszt glissando on the piano? And when talk about glissando, we're talking about this, you know, like on the string instruments, you can go, you know, on the string on one finger and do this glissando going to one note from the next. Very easy on the string instruments. But on the piano, how would we do this?
Well, anybody could do this. You don't even have to know how to play the piano. All you have to just put your hand like this and just do this over the keys. And then you have what you call a glissando. Now, the problem is you have to control that in this piece. And it has to be not super loud and super showy. That's absolutely not the intention of this. It has to be ethereal. And that's the hardest thing to do. When it is supposed to be like in the first concerto, when it is the return of the theme and it's going toward this big moment, yeah, it could be a little brash, but in this case, not. And again, I played it on a keyboard which was smaller than our keyboard. I played it on one of these instruments that has a super light action, and I almost can do it, but my hand is just too small to grip that, you know, and it honestly, it hurts. I've practiced glissando so much that I've been bleeding. So, you know, you don't want to do this all the time. So, but I think that, you know, effects are effects. And if you have something to say with this piece, I don't think that you should let one passage deter you from doing it. I think you should find a solution to it, which may offend people, and all the better, because I think this, you know, this wasn't there just to have one way of solving a problem. It was to, you know, in some ways inspire creativity and like, what, look how this person solves this issue, and wow, right, look at how that person can do it. And now I tell students, you know, don't, because they all, we all feel the same way, especially as young people, like, oh, how can I shouldn't even play this. Like, why? You know, what? And I said, no, well, that's not the point. The point, this is the point, is that you should play it because you'll find your own solution to it that'll be not anybody else's.
Right.
Again, some audiences will love it and others will.
You know, hearing you both talk about kind of changing fingerings to adapt how you can tackle that musical problem. I remember once seeing an interview with Emmanuel Axe and talking about going back and looking at some of Beethoven's manuscripts and seeing some of the fingerings that Beethoven used, and Manny saying, no one I know uses that fingering to play this passage.
That's great.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question too. I mean, that just, it's discussions and discussions, because there are certain things that you would redistribute in order to make it easier or more controllable, or so that the flow of the music is never, your idea is never pooled just because of a technical thing. Mm-hmm. But there are other things, now that we're talking about Beethoven, that I think you could solve in a second, but you don't, because there's something in the way that's written, the notes are written, that is so important, is so integral to the music that you cannot redistribute it. One of the most famous examples, I think, is the opening, just the first two notes of the Opus 111. It's the last piano sonata. It's two octaves, but they're really far apart, and it's in the left hand, and they go down. It's like you're leaping off a cliff, which it feels like in performance, because people miss it all the time. But if you solve it by playing right hand, left hand, the whole danger element, the whole aspect of leaping off into the unknown, which is what Beethoven is doing, is dispelled. And the perfection of it is completely missing the point of what this music is.
I totally agree with that.
I think, you know, it's a fine line that we walk. You know, there are certain things that I think you can redistribute and figure out. Mm-hmm. And there are other things that you just have to make the leap.
Now, Jonathan Biss performs the third movement of Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Biss, a frequent performer in the Philip Lorenz International Keyboard Concert Series, performing the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 21 in C major, the Waldstein. This is Beethoven, Creativity in Crisis from Valley Public Radio. Our special guest is pianist John Nakamatsu. Ray Hotoda continues our discussion.
What's interesting is that Beethoven's piano, even the Broadwood piano that he eventually was very, very happy with, was, I believe, 6 octaves. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, have 8 octaves. And then I think of the opening of the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto, John, that you played with us with the Fresno Philharmonic. And it goes, you know, that E flat major chord is just all up and down the piano. All 8 octaves are used, you know. Yeah. So it's just amazing how these things are continually transforming itself. It's continually opening up to new ideas and pushing more and more forward, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We'll hear just a bit of John Nakamatsu's performance of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, Opus 23, from a concert recorded in October 2018 at the Saroyan Theater in Fresno. Ray Hotoda leads the Fresno Philharmonic. Thank you. That was pianist John Nakamatsu with the Fresno Philharmonic performing a bit of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, Opus 23, from a concert recorded October 2018 in Fresno. This is Beethoven, Creativity and Crisis from Valley Public Radio. We turn now our attention to Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, and we return to our conversation with Ray Hotoda and John Nakamatsu.
So let's talk about the Eroica Symphony, the Heroic Symphony, Opus 55, the third symphony of Beethoven. This symphony, I think, really raises very fascinating issues for Beethoven during this time. So number one, he had these personal circumstances, his illnesses, really a big juncture in Beethoven's life, in his crisis. And number two, it's his relationship with the political events that were happening, and that this piece was dedicated originally to Napoleon, who Beethoven believed represented democracy and this anti-monarchical ideology of the French Revolution. And then thirdly, it was this way of the audiences to hear, again, like John, you were saying, this expanded form, a symphony that's almost an hour's length in its entirety. So it was difficult right away for the audiences to sit through the four movements of the Eroica Symphony because they thought, oh my gosh, this is just way too long. This is horribly long, as one of the critics connotated. But I think, you know, again, with its length, it's also presenting some really difficult technical challenges for the orchestra. And I think for Beethoven, it was a time for him and his contemporaries, other composers during his time, to rethink what is a symphony? What should it be doing? What is it saying? And for Beethoven, I think this symphony really epitomizes this fight against political tyranny. We want to look at the Eroica, the last movement. And John, do you know the Eroica variations for piano solo?
Yes.
Have you played them?
Yes, a long time ago.
Beethoven wrote the Eroica Variations for solo piano is Opus 35, and it was written a year before the symphony was written. But the last movement of the Eroica Symphony uses the same melody that this Eroica Variations uses. And the last movement offers 10 variations, and the Eroica piano variations are 15 variations. And I think it's so interesting that he's used material that he has written before, actually called it the Eroica Variations, and put it into his symphony a year later, the Eroica Symphony. John, can you tell us a little bit about your experience with the Eroica Variations?
It's been so long. You know, I haven't played that publicly probably since I was a teenager. So I don't know what that's
like. Wow. Says,
yeah.
Why did you learn it?
Well, that was one of the first major pieces that I learned of Beethoven. I mean, I had started with the smaller sonatas, of course, and then you know, went into the variations because actually it was a composition teacher of mine from the University of Southern California with whom I worked for about 10 years when I was very young, who said that you really have to study Beethoven's understanding of variations. And a variation, of course, for those of you who don't understand, you know, it's you get a theme, and then what ensues is just completely things that sound like the theme and then other things that don't sound like the theme, but they're all based on the theme. And in this sense, they're organized into, as you say, 15 segments that are pretty much related always to what he puts out. I love playing them, and I don't know why I haven't. When you said that you know, I haven't even thought about it for all this time. So I'm kind of happily reminded that I should be playing them. But you know, it's like all Beethoven to me, like where it just feels a little uncomfortable. You know, the C minor variations are the same way. You know, everything just doesn't, for the modern hand, doesn't feel right. And I think, again, it's going back to our talk of instrumentation and writing for really what was a different touch and different technical demands. So, yeah, I will go back to it one day.
I know for the orchestra, this Eroica symphony is very, very difficult technically. Just to get to the last movement is a feat in itself. But I think the symphony really has this unmistakable message of hope and freedom. And right away in the first movement, we hear innovation. He opens up with these E-flat major chords in the orchestra. And prior to that, like the second symphony, you know, we have an adagio introduction, and then it goes into the allegro, into the main theme. So with Eroica symphony, Beethoven's saying, no, we're just going to start right here. And this is what I'm angry about. This is the protest that I have right now in my heart. And when we hear about the stories of why it wasn't called the Napoleon Symphony or Napoleon Bonaparte Symphony, he heard that Napoleon crowned himself ruler, and instead of fighting for a democracy that he had hoped for, he said, no, my hope and dream was that there would be somebody who could really speak to our plight, the people, speak for the people. And when Napoleon did that, he just ripped apart the score and said, no, I scratched off Napoleon Bonaparte from dedication, and instead called it the Heroic Symphony. So I feel like right away in the beginning of the symphony, you hear these chords in forte saying, no, no, you know, and then he goes on to the melody. In this symphony, in the first movement, not only is the innovation of the beginning so striking, but in the development, he introduces a fugetta. And then there's a new theme in the coda. All these things has never happened before. And so it's really exciting to hear that. So then let's go into the second movement, which is the Adagio Assai. What do we have? We have a funeral march. It's as if this is the end of tyranny. For me, that's what he's saying. But it is the funeral march that is very, very famous and one of the most influential pieces. And in fact, John, remind me, one of the piano sonatas has a funeral march. I think it's Opus 26 in the third movement. And in the funeral march, he actually says funeral march regarding to the death of a hero. So it was really fascinating to see that he had done something like that before, again, with the Eroica piano variations, writing the Eroica symphony. And then to draw from a piano sonata earlier on and then put it into the second movement of the symphony. So it's just a nice kind of tie-in that he was doing compositionally there.
It's a really good point that you make. A lot of composers write music. You know, they're writing what is in their head, and a lot of it is sketched. And Beethoven's sketchbooks are one of the most coveted things on the planet, you know, because it gives you an insight of their thought processes and where these ideas came from and what eventually happened to them. Now, I think a lot of composers did this and recycled a lot of material, and often something would occur to them, but they wouldn't really find its place until later. We were talking about the Waldstein sonata. There was originally a second movement to that sonata, actually, that he later took out and published as, I think it's called the Andante Favori, which is a beautiful piece on its own, but I can't imagine playing it with that sonata. I mean, it's a beautiful, wonderful piece, but it just seems like such an independent statement that it wouldn't really, I don't know, maybe it's just me. But Beethoven also used these things constantly, but sometimes wouldn't leave as many clues. If he really didn't want something seen, he would destroy it. So a lot of these things that were used for different things and interchanged, I, you know, they're really significant because I think other things within that process, we don't see. We don't see everything that went on, you know, in the genesis of all of these works and how they were interrelated and maybe had been planned for one thing and then became something else.
The third movement is completely different from the first two movements. Again, like the Waldstein Sonata, very polar opposites in feeling and in energy. In the third movement is the scherzo. And all of a sudden, it's like dance-like and very light. It's so confusing coming out of the funeral march for the listener to go right into this mirth-like dance scherzo. And again, as in the Waldstein Sonata, we were talking about the rhythmic driving force. Well, in the third movement of the Eroica Symphony, I feel that there's so much of that is in this movement. And we have now piccato quarter notes. So it's in 3-4, but it's this wonderful, fast motoric rhythm that drives the movement forward. And then in the trio, of course, this is the first time that anyone has ever used three horns in the symphony. And so in the trio, we have this triumphant horn call, this hunting horn call that happens. Again, it's as if we're back in nature or something. You know, it's just this incredible dichotomy between the first two movements of the symphony. Speaking more about this rhythmic transformation that was happening in Beethoven's mind, he really pushes this duple, triple rhythmic aspect and this ambiguity that he creates in this third movement. And there's this alla breve right before the coda that goes into cut time. And it is a trap for conductors because all of a sudden you're going in three and then you have to go into two. And I don't know, pianists are great at this. You can do two against three so easily, you know. But tell us your experiences about, you know, any experiences of Beethoven that you've had where you had to switch gears right away rhythmically.
Like you say, we're just so accustomed to just learning how to do it really fast that I don't even think about it anymore. You know, those kinds of rhythmic discrepancies, once we get it in our head, you know, four against five or five against seven or three against two, you know, they become kind of part of what we do. But the fact that, you know, there are all these interesting occurrences of three in this piece too, you know, like there are three flats there, you're talking about the third movement and there's that triple. It's so interesting. I don't know if Beethoven was superstitious in the sense of numbers. I don't know too much about that. But do you know anything about that?
I don't actually.
No. Because I wondered. It was just there's so many instances, and like the first movement, how many first movements are actually written in triple time? I would say like not many of even his. Right. Sonatas, and you know that must have sounded strange too to hear something that's almost lilting, but there's something very stable about the number three as well. You know that the number four doesn't have four is always in danger of kind of being pushed one way or the other. But there's this kind of almost pyramid like geometric stability of a three form that you feel like like it can't be pushed over.
Right.
You know, so even though there's a lilt to it, there's just this strength. And I wondered always if it has to do with this like threes and that you compare it to the two. That's what you said is just so fascinating because like when the two happens, then that's when you notice, oh my God, it was three.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And what's interesting now that you mentioned that opening is that it's in three, but a lot of conductors like to do it in one. And I remember the first time I conducted the Eroica Symphony ever. I did the whole first movement in one. And there's all this driving rhythm underneath it that requires the conductor to give three beat. And yet I was determined, you know. Luckily, my players were fantastic at the time and got it. But it's just an interesting concept to, you could do a whole talk on that.
That's right. And I think it's a really interesting topic because like even just for our listeners, you know, it reminds me of that's the conductor equivalent to redistribution on the keyboard, you know, whereas we were talking about the 111 where you could play two octaves with each one in each hand and solve the problem. Or you can do this and you can feel the tension and like the every motion of it. So when you're conducting da ya yum ba ya, that's kind of an easier feel than ba da ya, where you're really feeling each beat, you know, and that adds something to it. And so how you choose, how a conductor chooses to meter something is a whole wonderful kind of door to express. And a door to different types of expression. So
right, and interpretation too.
Absolutely, and I think probably a lot of conductors I know just change depending on the music at that moment, can go from one to three or back and forth, and you know, right, just depending on what you want out of your players.
And that's what I eventually went to as a conductor, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, after conducting this several times. Mm-hmm. I go interchange between the one and the three beats. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the fourth movement now. So the innovation in the fourth movement, again, is really not an innovation because the fourth movement is in variation form. And so again, the Eroica variations that came before that, a year before in the piano piece. But what I find extraordinary about this variation is that, first of all, we hear the bass line first, the harmonic lilting quality of the bass line. So not only in these variations do we have a fugue, we have virtuosic flute solo, we have this G minor dance-like tanz, and then we have this expansive hymn with the brass at the end. I think it's just such an extraordinary movement, one that really conveys triumph, perseverance, and sometimes humor.
I agree. Absolutely. The journey, I think the massive proportions of this piece, like other pieces that have just these massive proportions, were just this way of taking the audience on this different plane. Because if you're really going to understand this music and really go with it, you have to allow yourself to get out of our time, you know, get out of like, well, it's really long. You have to just experience everywhere it takes you, because that's what we do as humans, you know, in our lives. We're just kind of on this continuum, and everything that feels, that makes us feel small is in some ways, you know, of great proportion.
I don't know about you, but I'm ready to hear this epic music. Here in a concert recorded January 2020 at the William Saroyan Theater in Fresno, music director Ray Hotoda leads the Fresno Philharmonic in Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E-flat major, the Eroica. We'll hear the third and fourth movements. Thank you.
you know, you're talking about just the circumstances under which this was written. I always remember that Beethoven, as much of a curmudgeon as he might have been, he had great faith in humanity. And as much as he might have hated what Napoleon had become, he felt that those people were just impediments on the road and that humanity would rise above that. And I think that you hear that in his music. You know, another E flat piece is the Emperor Concerto, which right. He didn't call the Emperor Concerto. I mean, that's another whole story. But you know, he wrote that in a basement where he was covering his head with pillows because Napoleon was basically bombarding Vienna. And so, you know, to complete his conquest of Western Europe here was Beethoven's once hero coming in to take over everything that he held dear. And yet this music is of the most positive, beautiful, triumphant. It gives you a purpose. And I think to separate the misery that he must have seen, I mean, it's like a war zone. It really was a war zone. Death, disease, dominion, everything negative. And out of that comes this in the same key of E flat. As you know, your heroic
and,
theme.
And exactly. And so, you know, I just find so much inspiration from Beethoven mm-hmm. in so Absolutely. Many ways. The music is so pure in itself. There's this incredible intent. He was so productive during these crises. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is so remarkable about Beethoven, in that during these crises, he had so much creativity.
Yeah. I wish we were all so propelled by our environment to work and to create. I mean, you know, there's even a whole different thought topic, which is that his deafness actually propelled him into the direction that he took in his later period. So, and that we wouldn't have had that type of music had he not gone deaf, you know, had he not been able to actually play this music. Because then at that point, music and that type of art becomes a concept to him, not something that was actually real or that he needed to use for his own as a vehicle. You know, in early in the career, you're making your name okay as a composer, yes, but you have to play your pieces and right. You have to be a pianist. And so largely these middle period works and what came before were to show him off again as an instrumentalist. He had no need for that at the end of his life. And so suddenly there was this music that was only of the mind and of the soul. And I think that's what makes his unique among any other composer and hopeful.
Well said, John. Well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been another edition of Beethoven, Crisis and Creativity. Special guest pianist John Nakamatsu, thanks so much for sharing your insight and passion with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Ray Hotoda, great as always to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Beethoven, Creativity and Crisis is a special program from Valley Public Radio in collaboration with the Fresno Philharmonic and the Philip Lorenz International Keyboard Concert Series. Thanks as always to Ray Hotoda and Stephen Wilson from the Fresno Philharmonic, as well as to all the musicians in the Fresno Philharmonic for their outstanding dedication. Thanks also to Andreas Wertz of the Philip Lorenz International Keyboard Concert Series. Special thanks to our guest this week, John Nakamatsu. For Valley Public Radio, I'm David Ouse.